Hello, everybody. I'm here today with Ron Myers from the Consulting Room. And we talked to Ron before, but today we're going to focus on the recent FACE conference, which Ron organised. So thank you very much for joining us today, Ron.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Adrian.
It was a great conference. So just tell me a little bit about, you know, your feelings about it, you know, how it went.
Okay. Well, I mean, well, thanks as well for getting involved and participating. I know that your session went very well as well. You did you did one on the PERMALIP, didn't you, as well, on the surgical session?
Yeah.
Which was kind of newer to the agenda this year as well. We also wanted to try and have a day looking at facial surgery as well, to try and bring in more surgeons. And certainly, I think some of the surgeons who attended that felt that that was a useful format to have in conjunction with all of the other non-surgical treatments that obviously were the focus of the meeting. I don't know whether you felt that was the case as well.
Yeah, I thought it went really. I mean, it certainly looked busier this year than any other year.
Yeah, I mean, we had probably, I think it was over 600 people this year, and with 85 speakers from all over the world and over 40 exhibitors. It was certainly the busiest year, and in fact, so busy there now that we've had to make the decision to change venues. So next year, it will be at a different venue, at the QE2, which is opposite the Houses of Parliament. So that will give us a lot more space.
Brilliant, brilliant. So tell me, so if anyone who doesn't know, can you summarise what FACE is and who it's for?
Yeah, I mean, FACE was started 10 years ago, and the aim really was to try and pull together a meeting with quality speakers focusing on scientific content relating to any treatments that would be used for facial aesthetics. And, of course, back years ago, 2002, when it was first started, 2003, sorry, there, it was mainly focused on injectable treatments, and it was just a two-day meeting. Now it's a three-day meeting, and we've got three lots of parallel agendas that focus on anything, including RF treatments, laser treatments, cosmeceuticals, peels, obviously all of the injectables, and various other things that fit into that kind of concept. And we also incorporate into it a two-day business meeting as well, because we feel that is also a very important aspect as well for people to be able to come and learn about, because clearly at the end of the day, this is a business as well. So it's no good having all of the skills there if you can't also attract the consumers in order to be able to utilise those and make money.
Absolutely. So there's something there for everyone. There's something for the practitioner and the, you know, the people that run the clinics as well.
Well, yeah, I mean, next year we are really even trying to sort of break that down even more and have sort of 3 days virtually for each individual type of person who might be involved in running an aesthetic clinic. So we're going to have a bigger agenda for surgeons. We'll have all of the non-surgical agendas there. They'll be aimed at the medical part of the marketplace. And we're aiming to put together a two-day meeting as well, really focused on what you want to call them, really. I mean, there isn't really a title. Some people will call them non-medical aestheticians or beauticians or laser specialists or whatever. But in general, beauticians who've gone on and specialised in laser RF treatments and maybe radio frequency as well, to really put together a focused agenda specifically for them and aimed at them. And then the face of the clinic, which is a business forum, we're going to extend that to a three-day meeting as well, and that can be aimed at marketeers within an aesthetic clinic as well as clinic managers as well, or, of course, individual business owners or entrepreneurs. So really, we will have literally, I think, something for everyone.
So, I mean, I certainly enjoyed it. The difficult thing is knowing which bit to go to, because you can't go to it all.
Well, that's right. I mean, it's like, I suppose it's like many meetings now that you go to at that kind of scale. I mean, and I'm the same as well. When I went to IMCAS, I mean, there's six different agendas, and then you've also got different workshops as well. And sometimes there is an overlap of looking at some of the things that you want to go and see. But I think it's trying to get that balance between providing a lot of different content there at different levels as well, because clearly, someone from your perspective who's been in the business for a number of years will be looking for something that's a little bit more advanced or different or new versus somebody who maybe just come in who might really want to just learn a little bit more about botulinum toxin and the kind of the basics really about how to use it for instance glabellar lines and crow's feet. So it is difficult when you're putting on this type of meeting nowadays, because you've got people who've got 10 years plus experience and some people who are just coming in ready to the market.
Yeah, absolutely. So Ron, I mean, I know there's probably far too much that went on, you know, over those three great days. But could you just give me some of your sort of take home, some of your, you know, things you took away from FACE?
Yeah, I mean, I think we did have one very interesting session, really, that related to, I think, the issue to do with partly really with regulation and looking at certainly dermal fillers and the whole CE marking versus FDA approval side of things. And so we had a consultant dermatologist, Tim Flynn, who really talked about the FDA regulations and how dermal fillers go through that approval system in order for them to be able to utilize them, legally that is, of which there are, I think, about eight. And then Candice Gulchin, who's a surgeon from Ireland, looked at the European legislation, which revolves around CE marking, where we have access to, 160-plus different fillers. And really looking at the problems associated with that. And I know that's probably very close to your heart as well, looking at the PIP issue and, you know, falling under the same sort of regulation where the implants had CE marking and approval here in the UK and were very widely used, but were not used in the States because they didn't, I don't think they even sought FDA approval, but certainly wouldn't have got it anyway.
Yeah, I think they did try, but didn't get it. So overall, it's much, much more stringent. So fillers in the FDA, but you know, have to be registered in America, have to be go through the FDA, and it's a much more stringent process than here. Could you just summarise the different, you know, different requirements?
Well, I think, I mean, in essence, fillers over there are seen, I think, go through a similar process to that of a drug, and so they're seen in the same sort of way. And so when you're looking at drugs, you're looking at probably about 5 million plus at least in terms of investment. To show that the product is safe and effective in human trials and human volunteers. And then there's post-marketing surveillance. And then if that device is altered in any way, shape or form, that the device then has to go through the same sort of process again. So it is very, very stringent. Whereas here over in the UK, there isn't actually any real legal requirement to look at patient studies, which makes it kind of crazy. And also you can make variations as well once you have got approval, CE approval, without having to go through any sort of major sort of, you know, process again of showing that difference, you know, needs to be tested in humans. In fact, Rajiv Grover I thought summarized it very well, and he said actually he felt that a stifled teddy bear, which falls under the same sort of kind of regulation, have probably gone through more patient testing or more kind of client consumer testing, if you see what I mean, than the breast implants that were associated with the PIP scandal.
Yeah, so it's amazing.
It sounds kind of crazy, doesn't it? Just sounds absolutely crazy. And I think, you know, very clearly, I think everyone there at the conference felt that something needed to be done. And I think clearly as well, Bruce Keogh is looking at this in terms of the cosmetic surgery view. Other people are as well. And I think there will be some moves to really hopefully tighten up on that. And of course, that doesn't just affect the cosmetic marketplace. You've also had this with hip implants recently as well. They're releasing metal ions into people's bloodstream. And in fact, one of my friends, unfortunately, he's got one of those, is now going through annual testing, and he's only 52.
Yeah.
So, you know, he's not really sure what's going to happen with that. So clearly something really needs to be done there.
Yeah.
The other issue really, you know, also related to kind of, which has been going on for years, is the who can and can't do what. And we've seen year on year other specialties wanting to get involved in this marketplace, and I'm sure you get calls all the time from a training point of view from people who say, you know, can I come and do this? Why can't I do it if you turn them away? That kind of thing. And in fact, we had, there's one member of the audience who was a nurse. She'd also trained as a podiatrist, and she actually stood up and said, why can't podiatrists do this? I thought Tim Flynn, sort of came out from behind the podium, and he just rolled his trousers leg up and he said, just tell him, he said, where does the foot end? Which I thought was quite an interesting way of trying to look at it and get your point across. But I think the serious point of this relates to the fact now that podiatrists have got or an insurance cover from some of the brokers and the underwriters. And this is an area that we are sort of trying to tackle ourselves as well and try to look at the reasoning behind that. Because I think podiatrists fall under HTC regulation. And that relates to about 213,000 members from different specialties. And you can see the argument as well, well, if one HPC specialty can do this well, why can't we all?
Yeah. And can you just outline, it's very different, the regulation, who can do these treatments in Europe, isn't it, Ron?
Well, it is, and that was another lecture that was given as well by Mike Regan, who is basically the chair for the British Standards Institute, part of the committee that relates to looking at our input into FEN, which are basically the European standards that are being pulled together to try and get some sort of conformity across all of the European countries in terms of looking at issues relating to environment, especially with regards to cosmetic surgery. What is the appropriate environment? What are the appropriate regulations in terms of looking at air exchange and protocols related to infection control, all those types of things. The other section they're looking at is who can and can't do what. And currently, I think dentists and nurses are being excluded from the groups, certainly from a European perspective, in terms of injectable treatments, for instance. So, you know, that there is a very clear difference that I can see there in terms of looking at the rest of Europe and the UK.
Yeah, because I believe in France it's really only dermatologists and plastic surgeons who are allowed to use toxins.
That is correct, yes. So, and again, a lot of this really relates to the fact of looking at, you know, the different specialties and the numbers of specialties that there are. In Europe, you tend to have a lot more dermatologists and surgeons than we have in the UK, where we've got, I'm not sure how many plastic surgeons there are, but I know there are about 155 DARPS members. I'm not sure how many BAPRIS members there are, but around about 550 dermatologists. And certainly from a dermatology perspective, I know the big difference here in the UK has been that a lot of dermatologists' private work is disease dermatology, so they haven't needed to get into cosmetic dermatology. And that's where the void has been and where other specialties have come in to sort of take over that part of the market.
Yeah, and it's the same with plastic surgeons. I mean, there's only there were only 120 plastic surgeons in the UK.
Yeah,
and,
tiny number.
Yeah, and they were doing all the NHS work. They had very little time to do cosmetic work. And that's when the big chain, that's when Transform first came up. It was a businessman who was behind it. And he saw all these patients wanting and needing treatments without anyone to do it. And that's when he set up Transform on business model and did very well, didn't he?
Well, he did. I mean, that was John Ryan. And I think the other thing that he put into that business model, which, of course, is an area that I think BARPS in general don't support, although I think there are some models there that maybe do incorporate it into their model, is having that first consultation with a non-medic.
Yeah.
And certainly with Transform, I think it's definitely part of that business model, is that where you go in and see a patient counsellor, or in essence a salesperson, who will take you through the, kind of what's involved and what may or may not be suitable for you, which, it has been undoubtedly a very successful business model, but something that I think a lot of people disagree with and say that first port of call should actually be with the person who would be doing the treatment.
Yeah, because we had a nurse who recently joined us, and she left one of the big groups who will remain nameless, and basically she didn't like the way they worked. Because basically the patients would see a counsellor first and be sold three or four vials, syringes of filler, and told that was great for them. And then they came through to her, the nurse, who felt that wasn't appropriate for them, didn't know where to use it. I mean, there wasn't enough volume deficit to use it. So she found that her clinical quality was really hampered by that.
Well, absolutely, and I totally agree with that as well. I mean, we don't operate that model at our clinic, and I can't see us ever moving towards that, although, you know, there are a lot of people that say commercially, and certainly I think pushing that into the dental part of the market, I think certainly more and more now I see marketeers saying that should be a component of it, because the consumer feels more relaxed with a non-medic in that situation. And so you can kind of understand the reasoning and the logic behind it. But as you say, the problem really comes down to looking at that person and what is and isn't appropriately sold. So I don't think if that model is used, that there should ever be a kind of sign on the dotted line bit here, there. You know, they should then go on and see the practitioner before any decision is made about purchasing any cosmetic treatment.
Yeah, I think our view would be that clinical decisions should be made by clinicians.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Anyway, moving on, Ron. So now, what were the take homes from the actual clinical point of view? Were there any new exciting treatments people were talking about?
Well, I think from a cosmetic sort of injectable perspective, I mean, I think certainly the trend, and you'll know as well, over the last sort of year or two has been towards looking at using cannulas and minimising trauma when you're putting in a filler in various, certainly sort of for facial volumisation anyway. But there was an interesting talk by a nurse who came across from the States who'd actually, she was called Leslie Fletcher, and she's actually patented a technique, not quite sure how you can kind of do this and reinforce it, but she's got a worldwide patent for this, something called Arcoderma. And really, it's actually going sort of the other end of the spectrum and actually trying to cause more trauma. And so the technique really is when you're going in and trying to look at injecting along vectors and putting the needle in, but taking it and ripping it through 90 degrees through the dermis as you're laying down hyaluronic acid. So the idea is you're actually sort of subcision, but laying down hyaluronic acid in that plane as well. So the idea is you're stimulating near collagenesis and getting improvement, but also you're utilizing less product in order to get a lift. So it's quite interesting. I mean, the kind of results that I've seen look similar to maybe what some people might be looking at with, say, for instance, RADS, and looking at that as a V-lift, or even looking at sort of Voluma in planes as well to try and sort of achieve a lift of tissues. But this very much relates to, you know, causing trauma. And so although there's not a lot of bleeding, actually, when you see it, when you see the treatment, undoubtedly you get more bruising associated with it. So the recovery time is going to be longer.
Yeah, but it's sort of using filler and trauma. And obviously, you know, it's a bit like the microneedling, isn't it? The more trauma, the thicker the skin, the more, you know.
Well, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, at the end of the day, when you look at all the clever devices that, you know, have been put forward, and certainly we had a whole day on the Friday as well. I mean, but you know, really, all of it looks at it's wounding, you know, in some way, shape or form. So I think certainly, again, the trend has been towards looking at causing these channels of wounds through a fractional treatment, as they call them, rather than a wound where you're kind of, which would have been done either years ago with a laser, where you would resurface the skin and basically just burnt off the outer layers and created an open wound, or you may have done that with a chemical peel as well, where again you're just taking off layers of the skin, and it depends on what type of improvement you're trying to sort of get, whether you use a milder peel or a deeper peel. And of course, deeper peels, you end up with an open wound as well. Have you ever used phenol peels?
I have in the old days, actually, Ron, yeah. But the downtime is quite a long time, isn't it?
Well, absolutely, and so the results can be good, although there can be also problems associated with that, pigmentation problems and scarring. Mm. And so I think now certainly the trend is to look at creating some form of wound, but maintaining the intactness of the skin surface. And if you look at the lasers now, and fractional lasers, some of them are getting very clever now as well in terms of looking at being able to assess the percentage of the skin that is actually ablated. If you're looking at an ablational fractional ablational CO2 ablation of the skin, and looking at basically only ablating 50% of the skin.
Yeah.
So that's kind of quite interesting. The other area is looking at using radio frequency in the deeper layers of the skin to cause skin tightening. Basically just trying to really focus the heat, and all of this revolves around heat when you're looking at skin tightening, into the dermal layer of the skin. So again, there are different concepts there as well. So that was interesting, looking at some of the refinements of that. And then of course you've got the other end of the spectrum, which is really looking at using it looks like a medieval tool, which is a dermal roll or a medical needling type of system, where again you're creating wounds with needles.
Yeah.
And Tony Chu, who's a dermatologist who's done a lot of work with acne scarring, showed something called a derma pen, which is basically a motorized version of a medical needling device. And he was claiming from his initial study that he'd done that with acne scarring patients, it was quicker than using a medical needling device. It was less painful for the clients or patients. You had a greater improvement, and also it was more cost-effective. So I think we might see more of the motorized sort of needling type of systems being used in the future.
Yeah, so sort of moving on from your manual lawnmower that your granddad used to work to the electrified.
Well, thank you for listening to the Cosmetic Courses podcast. Ron and Adrian will be continuing their discussion in the next episode.